So in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the fourth establishment of mindfulness, one of the practices that is given is to look at the senses and the sense objects and any fetter that arises dependent on the two. Any fetter being any mental state that's not useful that arises. So back to the example of walking down the street past the bakery, the smell comes out. There's the smell, there's your nose, and then the fetter that arises is you start craving and you go in and you eat a very unhealthy whatever it is, okay? Or you see something in the shop window, you didn't even know you wanted one, but now that you see it and it's on sale and now greed has arisen. Or you see that person wearing the wrong colors for the hockey team and hatred arises, okay? And so basically the Buddha says, notice what fetter has arisen. Notice how you can get escape from that fetter, all right? So for the bakery, yeah, you see it coming and you're like, okay, and you take the nice deep breath and you enjoy the smell and just keep walking, right? And then also know how you won't get trapped in the future. But there's much more on the senses in the suttas. In the connected discourses, the one that has the 56 different topics, one of the topics is the six senses, and there's 248 suttas on the senses, more than any other topic. Now, it's true, some of the suttas, there's a sutta on the eye, and then there's the identical sutta on the ear and the nose, all right? So they mechanically created them. But still, there's quite a lot of information in there about the senses and working with them, but it seldom gets talked about. My favorite discourse on the senses is the Bahiya Sutta. This comes from the Udana. The Udana is basically a collection of suttas. There are 80 of them, and there's a prose part, and then there's some verses at the end. And sometimes the verses at the end actually make sense given what was in the prose. And sometimes it's like, what? Right? In this particular sutta, this is the 10th one in the first book. It's the Bahiya Sutta. And the verses at the end actually do refer back to what is being talked about. So, thus have I heard. Once the Buddha was living at Savatthi in Jetas Grove, Anathapindika's park. Now at that time, Bahiya of the bark cloth was living by the seashore at Supaparaka. He was a holy man. He was wearing bark cloth clothing, and people gave him alms food and a place to stay, and if he was ill, they gave him medicine. Now, while he was in meditation one time, he wondered, am I an arahant, or am I at least on the path to arahantship? And it is said in the sutta that a deva, who was a former relative of Bahiya's, having compassion for him, appeared to Bahiya and said, Bahiya, you are not an arahant, and you have no idea how to become an arahant. And then Bahiya said to that deva, well, who in this world is an arahant, or who teaches the path to arahantship? And that deva said, Bahiya, in a far country there is the Buddha. He is an arahant, and he teaches the path to arahantship. And then straight away, Bahiya set his lodging in order, and then stopping only for one night at each location along the way, he headed towards Savatthi. Eventually he arrived at Savatthi, and when he went to Jetas Grove Anathapindika's park, he saw a number of monks doing walking meditation. And he went up to those monks and he said, where is the Blessed One? Where is the Buddha? And they said, the Blessed One Bahiya has gone for alms food among the houses. meaning he'd gone into Savatthi and was on alms round. Straight away, Bahia left Jetta's Grove on Atipindika's Park and headed into Savatthi to find the Buddha. And it wasn't too long before he came across him. He recognized him because he was attained to perfect poise and calm, controlled, a perfected one, watchful with senses restrained. Immediately, Bahia of the bark cloth rushed up to the Buddha and threw himself at the Buddha's feet and said, "Teach me Dhamma, O Blessed One. Teach me Dhamma that it may be for my benefit for a long time." And the Buddha said, "Bahia, it is an inappropriate time. We have entered among the houses for alms food." You see, if someone got their food by going on alms round, and they were a spiritual teacher, you didn't ask them for teaching while they were on alms round. If they stopped to give you a teaching, then when they finished their discourse, maybe all the alms food was gone and they didn't get to eat that day. Right? So it was very inappropriate for Bahia to interrupt the Buddha's alms round. And he responded, "But Lord, it is difficult to know for certain how long you will live or how long I will live. Teach me Dhamma, O Blessed One, so that it may be for my benefit for a long time." And the second time the Buddha said, "It is an inappropriate time, Bahia. We have entered among the houses for alms food." And a third time Bahia said, "But Venerable Sir, it is difficult to know how long you will live. It is difficult to know how long I will live. Teach me Dhamma so that it may be for my benefit for a long time." Now, sometimes if you ask a Buddha very nicely three times, he might grant your request. And so the Buddha responded, "Herein, Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In seeing, there will be merely seeing. In hearing, it will be merely hearing. In sensing, merely sensing. In cognizing, merely cognizing. In this way you should train yourself, Bahia. When, Bahia, for you in seeing there is only seeing, in hearing only hearing, in sensing only sensing, in cognizing only cognizing, then, Bahia, you will not be with that. When, Bahia, you are not with that, then, Bahia, you will not be in that. When, Bahia, you are not in that, then, Bahia, you will neither be here nor beyond nor in between the two. Just this is the end of dukkha." Now, through this brief Dhamma teaching of the Lord, the mind of Bahia of the bark cloth was immediately freed from the asavas without grasping. Then the Lord, having instructed Bahia with this brief instruction, went away. That's a pretty short discourse, and yet Bahia completely woke up. How did the Buddha know to give Bahia that particular teaching? Well, Bahia was wearing bark cloth. He was dressed like a tree, right? In the Upanishads, the spiritual teachings at the time of the Buddha, one of the collections is the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. And that particular teaching makes a big deal about trees. Bahia was dressed in bark cloth because he was a follower of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. If today you were to see somebody wearing an orange bedsheet and have a shaved head, you would probably go, "Oh, Buddhist monk," right? Well, if you at that time, if you saw somebody wearing bark cloth clothing, you go, "Oh, follower of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad." So when this guy throws himself at the Buddha's feet, the Buddha knows his spiritual background. And in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there's a passage that says, "In seeing, there is the unseen seer. In hearing, the unheard hearer. In sensing, the unsensed sensor. In cognizing, the uncognized cognizer. This is your soul, your self, your Atman. And so but the Buddha knew Bahi had been doing that practice, and he goes, no, in seeing, it's just seeing, in hearing, just hearing, in sensing, just sensing, in cognizing, just cognizing. And so when Bahia took a look at that, he immediately woke up. He immediately became fully awakened. It's very clear that the Buddha knew a great deal about other spiritual traditions at that time, because often he was able to give somebody some practice that very closely resembled a practice they had already been doing, but with just a slight tweak so that it was far more effective. And that's what he did for Bahia. Not long after the Lord's departure, a cow with young calf attacked Bahia of the bark cloth and killed him. This seems to be a hazard at that time. There were three other followers of the Buddha who were attacked by a cow with young calf and killed. One of them was the former king of Taxila. Taxila was where the great university was at that time. It would be, I guess, like Oxford or Harvard or something like that. And the king of Taxila heard about the Buddha, renounced his kingdom, and went to find the Buddha. And when he came east to the kingdom of Rajagaha, one night he asked a potter, someone who made pots, could he stay in his shed? And the potter said, yes, but there's already a recluse staying there. Don't interrupt this recluse. So the former king of Taxila went in and had a discussion with that recluse. And that recluse gave him a Dharma talk. And at the end of the Dharma talk, the king of Taxila realized he was talking to the Buddha. And he apologized and asked to become a monk. The discourse that the Buddha had given him had led him to the third stage of awakening. And the Buddha says, do you have your robe and bowl? And the former king of Taxila says, no. And the Buddha says, get your robe and bowl, and I'll give you the going forth. You can become a monk. So the king of Taxila went out to find a begging bowl and a robe and encountered a cow with calf and was killed. There was also Supabuddha the leper, who was out one day, and he saw a large gathering of people, and he thought, oh, maybe it's a free distribution of food. And so he went along, and no, it turned out it was just some guy giving a talk. But he sat down to listen, and it was the Buddha giving a talk. And at the end of that discourse, Supabuddha the leper attained the first level of awakening. But he too was later killed by a cow with calf. The commentaries mention that one of the generals in King Pasenadi's army was killed by a cow with calf. The commentaries go on to say that it was the same cow. I mean, the king of Taxila was killed in Rajagaha, and the others were killed in Savatthi, and there's a long way in between the two, right? But the commentaries go on to explain that in a previous life, these four guys were friends, and they hired a prostitute. And after having their way with the prostitute, they killed her. And now in this life, prostitute had come back as a cow and went around finding the four guys. You got to watch out for those commentaries. I think what we can ascertain is that you had to be careful. The cows and calves were just wandering around. And if you saw a calf over here, you might think that's its mother, and no, this was its mother, and you walk between and you were dead. Sort of like a drunk driver today. Someone went to Sangha, and when they were coming home that night, they were in an accident caused by a drunk driver and killed. Well, they didn't have drunk drivers in those days. They had cows with calves. But anyhow, poor Bahia was killed by a cow with calf. When the Blessed One, having walked for alms food in Savatthi, was returning from the alms round with a number of bhikkhus, on departing from the town, he saw that Bahia of the bark cloth was dead. So at least Bahia of the bark cloth got to enjoy his enlightenment for a few minutes, long enough to walk out of town. Seeing this, the Buddha said to the bhikkhus, "Bhikkhus, take Bahia's body, put it on a litter, carry it away and burn it, and make a stupa for it. Your companion in the holy life has died." "Very well." And they did so, and then they came to the Buddha, saying that they had done so. And then they ask, what is his destiny? What is his future birth? "Bhikkhus, Bahia of the bark cloth was a wise man. He practiced according to Dhamma and did not trouble me by disputing about Dhamma. Bhikkhus, Bahia of the bark cloth has attained final Nibbana." So he completely awakened. Then on realizing its significance, the Lord uttered on that occasion this inspired utterance, this udana, "Where neither water nor yet earth, nor fire nor air gain a foothold. There gleam no stars, there shines no light. There shines no moon, yet there no darkness reigns. When a sage, a Brahman, has come to know this for himself through his own wisdom, then he is freed from form and formless, freed from pleasure, freed from pain." So Bahia became enlightened, and the Buddha utters this inspired utterance, this udana. "Where neither water nor yet earth nor fire nor air gain a foothold. There gleam no stars, no sun shines light, there shines no moon, yet there no darkness reigns." Okay, so where the four elements don't apply, they gain no foothold. There shine no stars, no sun sheds light, there is no moon, and yet there is no darkness. So there's no light and there's no darkness. These dualities don't happen. When a sage has come to know this for himself, then he's freed from form and formless, another pair of dualities, freed from pleasure, freed from pain, or freed from sukha and freed from dukkha. Okay, again, another pair of dualities. So what the Buddha is saying is that if you can get beyond looking at the world in a dualistic way, high and low, good and bad, pleasure and pain, beautiful and ugly, form and formless, this is awakening. There's another sutta in the Udana. It's number 8. It's in Book 8, and it's the first sutta, and the Buddha makes very much the same statement, that Nibbana is looking at the world not in terms of dualities. Okay? There's another sutta that makes a similar point. This is the 11th sutta in the Long Discourses, the Kevata Sutta. That sutta appears to be two different discourses of the Buddha that have been jammed together to make one sutta. We find this happening quite frequently. The first discourse is not uninteresting. In that discourse, Kevata, who is a layman who lives in Nalanda, now Nalanda was the site of a Buddhist university, many years later, and you can go there today and see the ruins of the university. It's actually quite interesting. But at that time, it was a very prosperous place, not too far from the capital city of the kingdom of Magadha, Rajagaha. So this is a few kilometers to the north. And so the Buddha was staying nearby, and Kevata comes to the Buddha and says, "You should send some monks into town to do some miracles. If they do miracles, then this Nalanda is a prosperous place, and you'll get lots of alms food and robes and lodgings. And the Buddha says, well, this is not how we teach the Dhamma. There are actually three miracles. The first miracle is the supernormal powers, like walking on water, flying through the air. But everybody knows that if you have a Gandharan charm, then you can walk on water and fly through the air. So if the monks go into town and an unbeliever sees them walking on water or flying through the air, wouldn't they think, well, they've just got a Gandharan charm? Yeah, I guess so. The second miracle is knowing the minds of others. But everybody knows that if you have a Matika charm, you can know the mind of someone else. So if the monks go into town and they start reading people's minds, wouldn't an unbeliever think, oh, they've just got a Matika charm? Yeah, I guess so. The third miracle is the only miracle that counts, and that's the miracle of instruction. And what is the miracle of instruction? Here, a Tathagata arises in this world, teaches a Dhamma, someone hears it, gains faith, goes forth, joins the Tathagata's order, practices the precepts, guards the senses, is mindful of what they do, content with little, abandons the hindrances, practices the jhanas, does insight practice, gains insights, overcomes the asavas, and becomes fully awakened. This is the only miracle that counts. And that seems to be the end of the first discourse. In the second discourse, there's a very sudden shift, and the Buddha says, Kevata, once in my teaching, there was a monk who wanted to know, where do the four elements cease without remainder? And so that monk attained to such a level of concentration that he was able to go up to the lowest of the heavens. And he went up to the devas there, and he said, excuse me, can you tell me where the four elements cease without remainder? And those devas said, we don't know. Ask the four great kings in the next heaven up. So that monk got even more concentrated, went up to the next heaven, and asked the four great kings, where do the four elements cease without remainder? And the four great kings said, we don't know. Ask the guys in the heaven above. And so you get the picture. This monk going up through the heavens until he eventually reached the retinue of Brahma, the devas that serve the Lord of the universe. And he went up to those devas and he asked them, excuse me, can you please tell me where the four elements cease without remainder? And those devas said, we don't know, but you should ask Brahma. He knows everything. Well, where can I find Brahma? Oh, no one knows where to find Brahma. But how can I ask him? Oh, if you're patient, he'll probably show up. Well, how will I know when he shows up? Oh, when he shows up, there'll be a bright light and lots of smoke and a loud noise and the sweet, sweet smell of incense. Okay, so that monk went and sat in a corner, started meditating. And eventually there was a bright light and a loud noise and lots of smoke and the sweet, sweet smell of incense. And Brahma arrived and announced in a loud voice, I am Brahma. I am great Brahma, creator of the universe and Lord of all. I know everything. I see everything. And so that monk went up to him and said, excuse me, can you please tell me where the four elements cease without remainder? And Brahma said, I am Brahma. I am great Brahma, creator of the universe, Lord of all. I know everything. I see everything. And that monk said, I didn't ask you who you were. You already told me. Where do the four elements cease without remainder? And Brahma said, I am Brahma. I am great Brahma, creator of the universe, Lord of all. I know everything. I see everything. Look, look. Stop repeating yourself. Just tell me where the four elements cease without remainder. And then great Brahma led that monk aside and he said, these guys think I know everything. I don't know where the four elements cease without remainder. Look, from the looks of you, you're a Buddhist monk. Go ask the Buddha where they cease without remainder. So then, as quickly as a strong man could extend his arm or draw it back, that monk disappeared from the realm of Brahma and reappeared on earth and came to see the Buddha. And he went up to the Buddha, saluted, sat down to one side, and said, "Venerable sir, where do the four elements cease without remainder?" And the Buddha said to him, "You've been as far as the Brahma realm seeking that answer, and now you've come back to me. But your question is wrongly phrased. You shouldn't ask where the four elements cease without remainder. You should ask, where do the four elements, earth, water, fire, and air, no footing find? Where are long and short, small and great, fair and foul? Where are name and form wholly coming to an end?" And the answer is, where consciousness is signless, boundless, all illuminating. That's where earth, water, fire, and air find no footing. There, both long and short, small and great, fair and foul, their name and form totally come to an end. With the cessation of consciousness, all of this comes to an end. All right, this is a little bit cryptic. We can definitely see that there is the no footing, again, for the four elements, like we had in the Bahia Sutta. But we also see where consciousness is signless, limitless, and all illuminating. Where consciousness is signless, where consciousness isn't dividing the world up into individual things. If you look up here, what do you see? You see a candle, you see a plant, you see a water pitcher, you see a bowl, you see a person, you see a light, right? You're taking the holistic universe and chopping up it into individual things. You're making signs out of things, right? What the Buddha is saying is, can you experience the world without thingifying it, without making things? Can you experience the universe as a whole? Can you experience the universe as just unfolding, endlessly unfolding? Can you do it without boundaries? And can you see it without limitation, that everything is illuminated like this? It's a difficult mind state to try and describe. Apparently, the only way to know what he's really talking about is to have that experience. But this appears to be what the Buddha is talking about. The practice that he gave Bahia is the practice that we want to do so that we can go in this direction. Remember, he said to Bahia, "In seeing, let there be just seeing. In hearing, just hearing. In sensing, just sensing. In cognizing, just cognizing." Or in sensing would be in smelling, tasting, touching. Let there only be smelling, tasting, touching. And cognizing would be in mental activity, let there just be mental activity. When you can do that, there's no you in the objects, there's no you as the subject, there's no you in between. Just this is the end of dukkha. Well, that was enough for Bahia to wake up. But he'd been doing that practice for a long time, and the Buddha just tells him to look at it slightly differently. For us, it's a bit more difficult, all right? But this is a very good way of working with the senses, particularly off the cushion. When you go for a walk, can you just drop into seeing? Not seeing things, but just seeing. There's a holistic visual field. Can you see it without chopping it up into trees and road and barn and houses and cars and all the other things that we normally chop it up into? And when hearing, can you just rest in the sounds that are coming without it getting caught up in identifying, oh, that's a car, and that's a cow, and that's the sound of my footsteps? Can there just be the holistic hearing? And what you're smelling and tasting and touching, can you do the same with that? And any thought that comes through your mind, can you just see it as mental activity? And can you do this without separating it from anything around you? Without breaking the world up into solids, liquids, gases, and energy, into good and bad, and high and low, and beautiful and ugly, into materiality and immateriality? This is what the Buddha is pointing to. Remember last night, there was the quarrels and disputes that arise dependent on desirability or endearing, and then things that are endearing arise because they're desirable, and then desirable arises because pleasant and unpleasant. Pleasant and unpleasant arises from sense contact. Sense contact arises from name and form. And then the questioner wants to know how form ceases. And the Buddha replies, with consciousness or perception or conceptualization that's not ordinary, not abnormal, not of what has ceased, and that conceptualization also hasn't ceased. So it's looking at the world in this way as a holistic unfolding, not in terms of objects, not in terms of dualities. So the practice to do that is to go out and take a walk and see, can you just be with the holistic visual field? Just be with the sounds that are happening. Just be with the rest of your senses, including the mind. I sometimes like to say that you are not a noun. You are a verb. Because you're a collection of processes. There's your circulatory process. There's your digestive process. There's your endocrine process. It's much better to look at yourself as a verb or even a collection of verbs. I got this idea from Joseph Goldstein when he was giving a talk on not-self. And then I thought about it some more, and actually, there aren't any nouns. There are only verbs. It's just some verbs move kind of slow, and we think they're things, or people, or places, all right? But it's actually all in process. It's all moving. It's all unfolding. And this is what the Buddha is pointing to. Stop looking at the world as a bunch of things and see that it's just an unfolding. Right? Consciousness that is signless, not making a bunch of signs, a bunch of things out of it. Right? That sees the whole of the universe just unfolding. When you get really deeply into it, it's not a bunch of verbs. There's only this one verb of unfolding. That's all that's happening, this endless unfolding. And if you can rest in your senses and see that there's just an unfolding visual field, just an unfolding auditory field, just unfolding fields for the other senses, then you stop making the distinctions of high and low. Stop making the distinctions of good and bad, beautiful and ugly, etc. Now, there's still this last little bit. It says, with the cessation of consciousness, all of this comes to an end. Well, that had me kind of baffled for a while. With the cessation of consciousness, does this mean you have to go unconscious to become enlightened? That didn't make any sense. And then I was taking a course with John Peacock, and he happened to mention that the word we translate as consciousness, which is vijnana is made up of vi and jnana. Now, jnana very clearly means knowing. And the prefix vi actually has lots of different meanings. One of the meanings is divided. It can mean not, it can mean into, but I think it fits best with divided knowing. Consciousness is divided knowing. When you become conscious of something, you divide it from the holistic sense field. Look up here at the candle. Right? When you see the candle, you're dividing it out as different from the flowers or the water or me or anything. Now look really carefully at the candle. Now become aware of what's in your peripheral vision. Right? The things that were in your peripheral vision were there all along, but you weren't conscious of them because you were conscious of the candle. When I said become aware of what's in your peripheral vision, then you started dividing those things out from the holistic input. The input was there all along, right? And you started breaking it into pieces and noticing whatever the windows, whatever was in your peripheral vision. So with the cessation of divided knowing, all of this comes to an end. With the cessation of divided knowing, pleasure and pain, sukha and dukkha, comes to an end. So what the Buddha apparently is saying is look at the world without busting it up into a bunch of pieces. See that the universe is just unfolding. And if you don't try and grab hold of any of those bits and pieces in there, then there won't be any craving. And if there's no craving, there's no dukkha. Okay? So I'll leave you with just the recommendation to do this bahiya practice. This taking a look at the world and seeing it just as a holistic input with your eyes or your ears or any of your other senses.
Sometimes when I'm doing this sort of practice, I seem to get lost with reminding myself of doing the practice.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when walking in the garden or in sleep, I find myself repeating to myself all the seeing, all the hearing, all the thinking. It's...
Yeah, you get caught up in the instructions rather than the practice.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
This is a tricky thing because this is very subtle, right? It's very subtle to just step back and only there's visual field. If you find yourself caught up in the instructions, you can say to yourself, "Okay, too much instructing going on here. Just be with the seeing, and see if you can." Actually be with the seeing. It might not be very long, only a few seconds, and you fall out of it. It's okay, just get back in it. In studying with a Tibetan teacher, there's the Dzogchen practice, which is similar to this. And early on, I asked him how long you should stay in that state. And he said, oh, at least 1 or 2 seconds. You just keep falling out, but it's no big deal. You just go back into it and see if you can stop repeating the words so that you're just resting in that state. This is often a good practice to do if you're sitting in nature. And just open your eyes and look at the nature around you. All right. And then after you've looked at all the things, see if you can step back and just be with the visual field and just rest in that. Yeah, it might only take a few seconds before you lose it. That's okay. You can just come back.
Did the Buddha ever have a word, or in Pali, is there a word for just bare awareness or this kind of undifferentiated consciousness? I mean, it sort of seems to be a theme, especially in Mahayana Buddhism.
Yeah. It doesn't show up as a single word. There's another sutta in the Udana, it's number 8.3, and again, the Buddha is talking about Nibbana, and he says, there is, well, it's often translated, the unborn, the unmade, the unbecome, the unconditioned. So that's 8 words. 5 of them are wrong. Okay, there are no articles in Pali. There's no a, an, or the. Okay, so he never said there is the unborn or the unconditioned. He just said there is unborn, unmade, unbecome. And unconditioned is a pathetic translation of asankata, asakata. Better translation would be unfabricated or unconcocted. The stopping of fabricating or the stopping of concocting. Actually, in Pali, the words there, unborn, unmade, unbecome, unfabricated, they're past participles. But in Pali, past participles really take the place of what in English are gerunds, words ending in ing. So instead of unborn, would be more like not giving birth, not making, not becoming, not concocting. And who is the concoctor? Yeah, we're the ones concocting it all into individual things. So the closest word that we would find, the word that you would be looking for, would be asankata, asankara. Ah, meaning not, and sankara meaning making together or concocting or fabricating. So not fabricating, not concocting. That seems to be the word that most closely matches that. And it basically is pointing to the same thing that we're finding in these suttas.
Can you still, when you have this kind of I'm not sure if I can even write words, kind of just resting in taking in the unfolding.
Mm-hmm.
Can you still kind of see the scenery, but the mind is just not making anything out of that, or it gets even more like a...
Yeah, I think it goes more into that it's a whole and the mind is not making anything out of it. It is true, you can look at something and it starts breaking up into particles as well. But I would say that that's not as profound as when it's not even particles. Mm-hmm. It's just the visual field, okay? Particularly if you're doing the arising and ceasing practice. Then the world starts breaking up into particles and you start seeing that. But this gets, I think, even more profound than seeing a bunch of particles. It becomes... a whole. It's holistic. And it's not static. It's just unfolding. Think of a wave, a big wave, crashing into the shore. And you could take a picture of it, right? And it's going to happen like this. If you can see the world in that holistic way, it's like this wave, but it never really crashes. It's always just about to crash. It's always moving, just about to crash. And so it has a very vibrant, energetic, unfolding quality to it. But it's a holistic thing rather than a bunch of pieces.
I'm still wondering about it. But it's not the same as when you kind of completely relax the... Maybe I can't explain, kind of completely relax the mind from happening, and there's just a feeling, a sense of seeing and hearing something even.
You completely relax the mind, mm-hmm. and at the same time, you don't get caught up in taking what you're seeing and breaking it into concepts. There's just the sea, right? It's really tricky to try and describe. All I can suggest is go practice it. See if you can just be there with just the seeing. Probably what happens, you get a glimpse of it, and then your mind starts breaking it into concepts. And it's like, okay, that's all right. Just see if you can come back into the seeing. Or you're listening, you're just sitting there with your eyes closed and listening, and you're hearing the sounds of nature and so forth, and your bird call, truck, whatever. And then maybe for a few seconds, it's just sounds. And you're not trying to conceptualize it.
Well, this is something I've been practicing quite a long. That's why I'm not sure.
Yeah. It's a very good practice, and it's a very tricky practice. I mean, the jhanas, put your attention on your breathing. All right, that's pretty specific. And this is really out there, really quite nebulous. And you just want to keep playing with that. You might get insights while you're doing it. More likely, if you do this practice and then just stay mindful after doing that practice, that's when the insights seem to arise more frequently than while you're actually doing it. And then it's quite possible that you're resting in that and the whole thing just clicks in to such a deep extent that the thinginess of the world disappears. You just realize there are no things, and it all becomes this. It's not that you stopped making it into things. It's you realize there are no things, and that's really the underlying base of what's going on. And I think it's that point that the Buddha is saying that consciousness is signless, limitless, and all illuminating when that kicks in. But yeah, this is not an easy thing to do. In New York City, there's a performance hall called Carnegie Hall. And there's an old joke. A tourist is in New York, and he goes up to a New Yorker, and he wants to know, how can I get to Carnegie Hall? And the New Yorker says, practice. Okay? It seems to be the same thing on the spiritual path. How can I get to awakening? Practice. And so we keep trying it, and we didn't get the whole thing, but we keep playing with it. We keep looking in this direction of not breaking the world up into me and not me, and just trying to experience what's going on. One of the things I found most helpful for that is SODAPI, streams of dependently arising phenomena interacting. When I can look at the world like that, it's beginning to take me in that direction, right? When I see that I am nothing but the intersection of a bunch of streams of dependently arising phenomena, and this building is nothing but the intersection of a bunch of streams of dependently arising phenomena, and, everything that I'm encountering, I'm not seeing it as a solid entity, but just these streams interacting. And then I just can step back a little further and start seeing that there's nothing but streams going on. That seems to help. But even there, I'm conceptualizing streams, and I'm conceptualizing phenomena. Can I step back even further out of the concept of the streams, out of even the concept of phenomena, into just, now the words fail, right? I can't describe it. All I can say is go out and rest in your senses and just experience it without busting it up into things. Don't even bust it up into streams. And that's about the best I can do. I can just sort of point you in that direction. And then I run out of words and hope that you go out and do the practice and see what happens.
So is this anything like the practice that, for example, Shinzan Yang describes as do nothing? Like when you feel yourself trying to do something, you just drop it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just do nothing.
Yeah. He's definitely pointing in that direction. Yeah. Can you just be? I mean, we talk about being human beings, but most of the time we're busy being human doings. Can you just drop back into being? that'll take you in this direction as well. Yeah. There are definitely teachings in Zen that point in this direction, as well as like the Tibetan Mahamudra and Dzogchen practices. I think they're all trying to point to the same thing. Can you experience the world in a non-dual way? Can you stop making me the subject and all the other stuff the objects? Can you just rest in what's unfolding? Can you just even stop it being things and it's just the senses? When you get there, there's nothing to crave. There's no craving, no dukkha.
I have a question about craving in general. I was on a retreat this summer, and they used to have like hand-picked blueberries with the dinner quite often.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that when I ate a blueberry, well, it tasted good for a very, very short while, and then craving arose for more.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just came to think, okay, so what's the point? Because the dukkha from the craving is actually at least as big as the, or it's bigger than the enjoyment from the sense pleasure.
Right.
So I just thought, okay, so there's no point, and I stopped eating the blueberries.
Right.
I thought about the same thing with the chocolate here now.
Uh-huh.
And so what I'm thinking is whether it's more useful to go into the place where you experience craving so that you can watch the craving and maybe the craving will cease at some point, or maybe would it be more useful to just avoid the sources of craving?
It depends. If you can work with the craving skillfully and not get into too much dukkha and not get into unwholesomeness around it, then it's often very good to take something like chocolate or blueberries and just explore what it's like. So you put the chocolate in your mouth, and there's the pleasantness and the pleasant taste, and you chew it up and it's gone. And now there's that craving, I want some more. And already had all the pieces I can have in there. So can you do it the next time it's available, put it in there and just totally enjoy it, knowing that this is the end of it, all right? It's a very tricky thing to be able to enjoy a pleasure and then not get lost in the craving as time progresses. And that's a very useful exploration, I think. If you're always pushing the pleasures away so you don't get caught in craving, you wind up with a very dull life, right? And you'll probably lose it at some point and get completely lost in something. But if you start working with, okay, here's how I can enjoy a pleasure and not get lost in craving at the end of it, that's probably more profitable. And that way you can continue to enjoy life. And when the enjoyment stops, it's like, okay, the enjoyment stopped, and you go on. I think that's a better place than running away from it. So it's more like exploring the pleasure and then exploring the craving and seeing, is it possible to come to terms with the fact that there's pleasure here and then it goes away? Okay, no big deal. I enjoyed the pleasure and now it's gone away. There's, I've forgotten who this is from, but there's a line in some poetry in English, better to have loved and lost than to never have loved at all. Which, yeah, okay. I mean, you could avoid ever having a breakup by never getting in a relationship. But that's pretty stifling to your growth, I think. And so better to have loved and lost than to never have loved at all. And it's the same thing. Better to have explored eating the blueberries than never to have experienced pleasure at all. That would be my take on it. But But then you got to remember, you're asking a greed type here for their take. So if you ask a teacher who's an aversive type, you might get a different answer.